Well, a big score, Emilia Mahogs wave to Johnny's for driving us through this afternoon. It is Tuesday, the 30th of August. I'm Shane Dawson alongside Ruby Walsh, and you are listening to Game On. Coming up this evening, we have the Extra.ie FAI Men's Cup 2022 quarterfinal draw live in studio in the company of Cup winners Alan Keane and Mark Rossiter. However, there is also the small matter of Bohemian Football Club parting company with manager Keith Long to discuss.
After that, we will go across the water and around the grounds at the Premier League for all of tonight's fixtures, all four of them, and Mark Langdon has the latest on more big transfers as deadline day looms.
While in tennis, we're also looking back on Serena Strong's showing, it's tough to say, and her swan song as well, Ruby, in the US Open last night, and some shock exits. All of that, plus the rest of today's news. As always, if you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552 or tweet us at GameOn2FM.
Game on 2FM.
So Shane, the Extra.ie FAI Men's Cup draw will come up in a few moments' time, but there was news in other sports. Cycling, Sam Bennett's out of the Vuelta España.
Yeah.
And Cameron Smith, the world number two, gone to live.
Yeah, exactly. As expected, to be fair. Firstly, I suppose with Sam Bennett, because he started so well, so his hopes of winning the green jersey at the Vuelta España have been dashed after he was forced to withdraw from the race ahead of Stage 10 time trial due, unfortunately, to COVID-19. The Carrick and Sherman, who had sprinted to two stage victories already in the race, lay in second place in the points classification, becomes the 12th rider forced out of the Vuelta due to the virus. Yeah, really, really unlucky stuff there.
Incredibly unlucky for him. But what about not telling Matt Pedersen that your main rival, Sam Bennett, didn't line up today? So look, you don't need to kill yourself today. There's a sprint tomorrow.
Yeah.
I mean, listening to Sean Kelly earlier on Eurosport, I mean, that was crazy stuff. With all the technology they have in cycling, nobody in the team thought of telling him Sam Bennett wasn't in the lineup. That is
ridiculous. Let's call it what
phenomenal.
It is. Absolute. Shambles. Shambles. But however, sticking with cycling as well, before we chat Cam Smith, Ruby, Cycling Ireland has opted against sending a team to the upcoming World Championships, citing a shortage of resources to fund the venture. The 2022 UCI Road World Championships take place in Australia from the 18th to the 25th of September. However, the governing body believes that their limited budget is better utilised elsewhere. So a strong emphasis has been placed on European events, junior and under 23 riders this year, according to Cycling Ireland, who conceded that the World Championships was an event where success is far from assured. So, Sinead for the cycling. But as you mentioned, Ruby, at the top, Open champion Cameron Smith has become the highest ranked player to join the Saudi Arabian funded LIV Golf Series. The 29-year-old world number two has been confirmed in the field for the next LIV tournament in Boston. The Australian will be joined by rising star Joaquin Nyman, the 23-year-old world number 19 from Chile. I know you were chatting golf yesterday with Craig Allen. I mean, I suppose it is the biggest name. It's not ideal.
No, it's putting more and more pressure on the PGA, isn't it? I suppose we see it here as in thinking why. I mean, there's enough money in the PGA. It was or still is the biggest tour. Mm. When you look down through the list of names that have departed the PGA and have gone to live, I mean, Cam Smith, Jacqueline Neiman, Harold Varner, that went today, Cameron Tringle, Mark Leishman, and Arabane Lahimi as well. But you start looking at the other names and they just jump off the page at you, like Brooks Koepka, Bryson DeChambeau, Dustin Johnson, Bubba Watson. You know, they're just huge names. Charles Schwartzel and Brandon Grace, and global names. I mean, Australians, South Africans, Chileans. Like, I know they're trying to make it a global tour live, but I know we probably see it from here, or I see it in my feelings. Like, you think, well, Rory and Shane are still playing there. That's the one I want to watch. But when you think of the world and the size of the world, they're going to make a dent.
Yeah. And I know even, I think Greg Allen, RT Sports Greg Allen, was tweeting earlier that a former tennis world number one was even mentioning that tennis are keeping a close eye on things. So will be interesting to see how it all unfurls. And speaking of tennis, Gina Nyland will be joining us later, as I mentioned, at the chat US Open. However, Ruby, standing across from us is Alan Keane and Mark Rossiter, because there is some association football news, and that is to do with the League of Ireland. And in particular, It is with great regret that Bohemian FC has today parted company with men's first team manager Keith Long. The board of Bohemian FC wish to express our heartfelt gratitude for Keith's dedication, loyalty and success during his time at the club. When Keith joined Bohemians in October 2014, he joined a club that had a multi-million euro debt and its future existence very much under threat. Thanks in no small part to his dedication, Bohemian FC is a very different place to the club he joined nearly 8 years ago. So Trevor Crawley and Derek Pender will take charge of the team on an interim basis. The full statement is on the Bohemian FC website. And as I mentioned, Ruby, Alan and Mark across from us, Mark Rossiter, obviously with strong Bohemians connection. So if I come to yourself first, are you...
I'm glad you went to him and not me now, in all fairness.
Well, Ruby, I'll do the rounds. Don't you worry. I'll be coming to get your thoughts on next season
so
far.
Come back to me when the draw comes on. Go to the lads for the news.
Well, listen, you know, obviously you've been keeping up to date. They had a poor Dublin derby defeat yesterday as well, and there was another defeat for a Dublin club which we won't mention.
Shells got beat as well, didn't they? Yeah, 1-0 last night.
Sure, these things happen, Ruby. Of course, in Talca Park, a stadium enmeshed in the cultural life and sporting traditions of Dublin City since 1924. Mark Rossiter, are you surprised Keith Long has departed Bohemian Football Club?
I am surprised. I thought he genuinely would have got till the end of the season. I'm one of the people that believes he's probably got the hardest job in the league, having to do a rebuild every year. He's after bringing in a number of players and lost a number of players in the window. So I thought he would have got a little bit more time, to be honest.
Alan, obviously results haven't been ideal this year. But as Mark said, it's very tough circumstances. I mean, he had a contract there until 2024. So I suppose it's in that sense, it's probably going to take a lot of Bohemians fans off guard.
Yeah, well, but to be fair, I think a lot of them this year weren't too happy with the way the results were. I think going back to last year, they had the opportunity to get Europe, and I think they kept huffing and puffing, and I think since then they haven't really kicked on, and their consistency has been poor enough. And look, they haven't won in the last four games in the league, and look, I feel for Keith, as Mark touched on there, he has to rebuild every year, but so does every manager in the league. That's the nature of the league. You're on 9 month contract, so you do lose your better players. Yes, he's lost a few quality players throughout, but unfortunately football is a results business, and it's unforgiving at times. But yeah, it's disappointing because, as I said, he's one of the good guys of the league, but maybe it's time for change.
Mark, as a former Bohs player, I'm assuming still a Bohs fan, who would you like to see in charge now?
I don't know. Like, me and Alan were talking off air about it, and seeing, I suppose, who's about the league and stuff like that. If you were looking within the league, you know, Andy Myler's done a great job and a good, I suppose, philosophy of football that he has at UCD, but there's no expectation on UCD. So I wouldn't be surprised if they've already earmarked somebody outside the league, to be honest.
I will say, Roddy Collins is bringing a book out.
Would you be happy to see Duffer go, Shane?
Would you,
Alan,
want him?
Alan, you're asking an impartial journalist there, a general League of Ireland question. I can't imagine Damien Duff will be departing Shelburne because sure isn't he a one club man. Right, gentlemen, Bohemians are in the extra.ie FEI Men's Cup draw, and that is what we're here to get underway, and that's what we're here to do. Bohemians will be in the draw alongside Derry City, alongside Dundalk, Shamrock Rovers, the aforementioned Shelburne, managed of course by Damien Duff, Treaty United of Limerick, UCD and Waterford as well, who are in the First Division. So six Premier Division teams and two First Division teams. The matches to be played the weekend of September 18th. So if we are going to get underway, Ruby, and...
For the sake of on air now, Shane, first team out, are they at home?
Ruby, yes, leaving out one very vital clog of information there. So first team out are at home, obviously, and Alan, I believe, will be drawing the home team. So Alan will be drawing the first teams out, and then Mark Rossiter, as you mentioned, a cup winner with Bohs a few years ago now, and Alan Keane, three-time cup winner with Sligo Rovers. So Alan is already, Jesus, straight out of the box.
Shelburne FC.
And now Shane Dawson is hoping Treaty United come out.
Ruby Shelburne, 7-time winners, 3rd in the Roll of Honour, last winners in 2000. That nutsy Fenlon strike, of course, against Bowes.
Lost to Derry City 1-0 last night.
They did indeed. Fact.
Bohemians.
Oh, Shane Dawson has fallen off the seat.
Well, that's it. Dublin Derby, Bohemians, 7-time winners.
New manager, they'll be on the bounce.
They will, they will.
Treaty United.
Everyone in former Limerick FC are hoping maybe UCD might bounce out here. Who else would they like, Shane?
Possibly could be a first division club for Waterford.
Beat Usher Celtic.
UCD.
Ooh, UCD.
UCD.
Okay.
Won the cup once, didn't they, Shane?
They did, back in 1984, Ruby. Beating Shamrock Rovers in the aforementioned Tulka Park. Sure, we're getting loads of Tulka Park
Galway
references
United
in, Ruby.
3-2 in the round of 16.
Waterford FC.
Waterford, one of two first division teams left in the competition, with Treaty already drawn earlier. Twice winners, looking to bridge that 22-year gap since their last FAI Cup lift.
Beat last year's winners in the first round, didn't they? 3-2.
They did. Not Pats out. Yeah.
Dundalk.
So Dundalk.
Dundalk will be travelling to Waterford. Extra time penalty from Robbie Benson, getting them over the line into the quarterfinal draw against Wexford.
Derry City.
Derry City and the Ryan McBride Brandywell. 5-time winners. Won the last FAI Cup in the old Lansdowne Road back in the day as well, 2006.
Who are they playing, Shane?
Well, I hope I can guess who they're playing. Or else.
Shamrock Rovers.
Shamrock Rovers.
Wow.
So current leaders of the League of Ireland Premier Division against current second placed Derry City. So some big ties there. So just to recap the draw there, it is Shelburne versus Bohemian Football Club, Treaty United versus UCD, Waterford FC versus Dundalk, and Derry City versus Shamrock Rovers. Well, I suppose they're all big ties, quarterfinals, but I suppose first against second, let us start with the fourth quarterfinal, Derry City versus Shamrock Rovers. Mark, again, we saw Rovers having to contend with a few refixed matches due to their European run, and Derry had a refixed match yesterday. Obviously, a good win in Tulka Park. I think hat tip to Conan Byrne on Twitter, but it's their fifth league match they won in injury time. So they're digging in after a bit of an indifferent start as well. But a match that both Derry and Rovers fans will be very much looking forward to.
It'll be an unbelievable cup tie. Genuinely, you know, I think any team or any of the top so-called top teams will be looking for a home draw, not necessarily against Shamrock Rovers, but I think in the cup that Derry will fancy themselves against anybody. So provided that they got a home draw, I think they'll be happy enough.
If Derry put Rovers out, someone has to put the other one out, obviously, in the quarter final. But it does open this competition up for a smaller club. Treaty United versus UCD. I mean, that gives a smaller team a great chance to get to one of us, get to a semi final, and who knows in a cup competition, get the other side of the draw to Shamrock Rovers. Who knows what could happen, lads?
Yeah, absolutely. And even Waterford at home to Dundalk, same thing. You know, they'll fancy themselves down there. It's not an easy place to go either and win. And they're going really well under the new management as well. So it'll be an interesting cup fixture.
Alan, Shelburne versus Bohemians in the historic Tulka Park. Listen, Bows have probably gotten the better of Shells for the most part this season. Shelburne managed to dig in and get a draw with 10 men against Bows recently enough as well. But we were talking off air about perhaps if a new manager is announced, Trevor Crawley and Detzer are taking charge of Bows in the interim. And by the time these matches are played, by the weekend of September 18th, Bows could have a new man in charge. We're not sure. But even with Keith Long going, regardless, there's going to be a bit of a new voice, a new setup there. Yes, there are people that were involved, but we've seen it in Sligo when Liam Buckley left and John Russell came in, that teams can get a boost, so Bohemians are going to be dangerous.
Yeah, they will. And look at it, all depends, as you said, if they do get a manager in and how the players react, whether he wants them players in certain positions. At the end of the day, it's Keith Long's team. But all form goes out the window when it comes to cup football. And to be fair to Shelburne, they've been very difficult at home this year, and I think it's in for an absolute cracker of a tie. The only, I suppose, the teams that are not in the cup are disappointed, would be disappointed, would be St Pat's and Sligo Rovers, who are vying for that fourth spot in the league to get hopefully one of the top three win the cup. So Derry getting Shams is a very is a kick in the teeth to them. They wouldn't want to have seen that. But overall, I think you know, you look at the standout fixtures, Shelburne and Bowes and Derry City and Shamrock Rovers, it's going to be a cracking weekend.
Excuse my ignorance here now, Shane. Do we have another draw for the semi-final, or is that format worked out now? First and second, for two teams play. Can we work that out now?
No, we don't at the moment, Ruby. That'd be another draw. However, Ruby, listen, I'd be open to having it on Game On. Like, you know, if our producer, Ronan Lawler, can talk to
hierarchy. Imagine, like, Treaty, UCD, Waterford, Dundalk, yeah.
I wouldn't say no. No, it will be interesting. But Treaty, like UCD, and it's a great opportunity for those First Division clubs, as you mentioned there. I think the last time a First Division club was in the semi-finals, 2018, when UCD went on their run, they lost out to Dundalk, who eventually went on to win the cup as well. But UCD going down to Treaty, you know, that is going to be an interesting semi-final as well. And then the two kind of big Premier Division ties as well. So, yeah, no, a lot of football to play. And then, I suppose, following up with the Shells Bows as well, Alan, just before I went off on a bit of a tangent there, what have you made of Damien Duff and Shelburne? And I ask that sincerely. I know we were having a bit of a laugh earlier and whatnot, because we're talking about the managerial positions with Bohemians as well, but in terms of what he's done with Shells so far, and I mean, for all eight teams in this, I mean, win the cup and it's a trip to Europe.
Yeah, that's it. Look, at when they first come back into the league this year, I said the main thing is to stay in the league. I didn't think they'd do as well as they've done. I was really impressed in the first game of the season against St Pat's, and I think Damien is trying to bring a professional structure to the club. I know they're on a part-time basis, but even though it's one of the games there, he brought the lads into a hotel, got the food, and that pays off overall. And I think going forward, I think eventually Damien be looking to go full time, and the main thing for Shelburne this year was to stay in the league and a good cup run, and now they have a good chance at home against their Dublin rivals, and who knows, as I said, cup competition. If they won the cup this year, it would be absolutely remarkable.
Okay, gentlemen, good stuff. Mark Rossiter, Alan Keane, two former FAI Cup winners, thank you very much for partaking in the extra.ie FAI Men's Cup to get the full title. So just to confirm there, it is Shelburne versus Bohemians, Treaty United versus UCD, Waterford versus Dundalk, and Derry City versus Shamrock Rovers, first against second in the Premier Division at the moment. So those matches will be played the weekend of September 18th. Keep an eye across the FAI Twitter and SSE Electricity League social media for confirmed fixtures over the next while. But some really really good matches there to look forward to. Gentlemen, thank you both very much.
Shall I have a little start for you?
Yeah, go on, Ruby.
In the eight games in the round of 16,
yeah,
only one home team won.
You're going to ask me
Shells
who it was.
Are at home, aren't they?
Shells.
Oh. In Talca Park.
Talca Park.
Wouldn't be boding well if you're going on that stat, 3 out of 4.
Ruby, I feel you have me on tender hooks here. This is unnecessary, is what this is, Ruby. It's unnecessary. But anyway, but yes, Shells will be playing in Talca Park, the first floodlit football match in the Republic of Ireland, played there, of course. It was the first venue for the first televised League of Ireland game in 97, first televised Women's National League game in 2021. Speaking.
That's his cue, lads, to leave a donation at the Shelburne Park or Talca Park on your way out.
Well, no, actually, I was mentioning the first ever televised Women's National League match because we here at Game On are continuing our build-up to the Republic of Ireland's crucial World Cup qualifier against Finland this Thursday, a game you can hear live on 2FM. Earlier, Tony O'Donoghue, RT soccer correspondent, caught up with Louise Quinn and began by asking her about lessons learned from the last time the sides met.
Yeah, I think so. Obviously, in terms of the result, I think even when we look back, yeah, we could have actually performed a little bit better in moments, could have had more control of the ball, a bit more composure on it. But I think as a, what would be the word? I just think as a whole, we overcame something in that game. We overstepped where we took control of the game and scored goals, defended well, kept our composure where we needed it, especially, yeah, in the last few minutes. We knew we were kind of then starting to bank it up and that, yeah, they were going to put pressure on, and how they like to put pressure on us, longer balls in the box. But again, if you look at who we had in the box that day to defend, you even had Heather Payne coming all the way up from you know, from the front all the way to the back to, you know, do one of the best slide tackles of, you know, I've seen in a long time in terms of, you know, a goal saving chance. And again, yeah, I remember Niamh Fahey just being as solid as a rock and probably winning more headers. They're actually more, you know, going to her and she's winning every single one of them. You know, and that sort of experience and that will and determination, I feel like we overcame kind of something that we sometimes haven't been able to do and hold on to a result and keep it and also, you know, play some good football as well. We're just going to, you know, it's the same for us. It's any other game. It's a World Cup qualifier. It's a massive game. You know, we want to win as many as we can. We want to perform as best as we can. So, yes, there may be this external pressure, but we've had this expectation on ourselves, you know, from the start of the campaign, and we're handling it in the way that works for us and feels good for us. So, yeah, you know, there may be that, you know, bit more chat outside it, but we understand what we have to do, and learning from kind of past experiences. And for us again, it's about being realistic. Finland, they're a very, very good team. You know, they've made the Euros, and they, you know, they still have that kind of same solid squad that they had from that. So for us, it's still going to be, you know, it's a massive task for us. But again, if everyone is, you know, is up for it and is 100%, you know, we've a big, big chance.
It's a very special group. I can see that, and that goes for all of you. And I know that Vera Powell revealed, you know, traumatic details of her own personal life, and she spoke to you about that since. I mean, how has the rest of the squad responded to her?
Yeah, this responded, you know, exactly how, you know, I thought we would have as a group. Just excellent. We just have so much respect, and you know, just seeing how brave and strong Vera was. You know, she even did so much as well to protect us, you know, away from it. Obviously, you know, coming out in the media, and she did that for us. She still put her personal life on hold to make sure that we were protected. You know, and that kind of speaks volumes to me about the kind of woman she is. And yeah, and then obviously she's come in. I think how she's handled it, I think how the group has taken it on. Obviously, it's very, very tough. We're, you know, we've known Vera now for a few years, and you know, we all get very close in camp and very tight knit group. And for something to be happened to one of our people like that, you know, it's very, very tough. But again, she's just shown how strong you can be, how brave you can be, that to actually open up and talk about that sort of stuff is huge. And yeah, she said it herself, she's the same Vera, but, you know, even just better now. You know, and she has this sense of freedom, and for me, that's, yeah, to kind of come out and, you know, how she's handled it and managed it, there's nothing but, you know, love and respect for Vera.
As Shane has said, that massive clash between Ireland and Finland at Tala Stadium will be live on Game On from 6 p.m. on Thursday evening. But we're going to take a quick break and we'll be back to talk tennis.
Game On.
Tennis.
Yeah, you're very welcome back to this evening's Game On after the drama of the Extra.ie FAI Men's Cup quarterfinal draw. Just a recap for listeners just tuning in now, the quarterfinal draw paired Shelburne with Bohemian Football Club, Treaty United with UCD, Waterford and Dundalk. And first against second in the league, it is Derry City in the Ryan McBride Brandywell against Shamrock Rovers. However, we are going to chat tennis because I'm delighted to say that Gina Nyland joins us now, and to chat specifically, Gina, the US Open. And I want to begin with, I suppose, the star attraction, the main event. So much of the narrative of the US Open has been surrounding Serena Williams, and rightly so, because she is looking to extend her US Open farewell after she overcame her opponent with a gritty opening win on an entertaining night packed with hope and celebration in New York. Williams, who was set to retire after the tournament, won in straight sets against Montenegro's Danka Kovanic. The 40-year-old will play Estonian second seed Anett Kontaveit in the second round tomorrow. The 23-time Grand Slam singles champion, who is one short of Australian Margaret Court's all-time record, is also playing in the doubles alongside older sister Venus, adding another exciting element to what she hopes will be a long goodbye this fortnight. My first question, first and foremost, how difficult is it just trying to park the fanfare and everything else that goes with it and just focusing on the job at hand, and that is playing a bit of tennis and winning a few matches?
Well, look, it was something else last night, wasn't it? It was like something out of a boxing fight, or I mean, Serena's entrance alone onto the court was extraordinary, with her outfit, which was some kind of a flowing cape with diamonds encrusted on it, crowds cheering, full of celebs everywhere. Serena loves the drama of it, and she's certainly not going to go out without a show. So if last night was going to be her last night, she was going to go out all guns blazing, as it were. But, you know, she got through it and she won it. So I think she could have had a tougher opponent last night, but, you know, her opponent, Kovacic, you know, obviously is a good player, but, you know, an easy enough start for Serena there. I don't think Serena's in any danger of winning the event, but, you know, every match that she gets on the big stage for her is a bonus, and she'll just want to keep going. And I'd say we'll take confidence from last night and soak up that atmosphere and want more of it when she plays again on Wednesday.
25,000 people in the Arthur Ashe Stadium last night. I'm sure there'll be 25,000 more tomorrow night.
Oh,
she's getting the send-off she deserves, isn't she?
Yeah, absolutely. And look, she's an absolute legend of the game. The greatest woman tennis player of all time, no doubt. You know, and possibly the greatest tennis player of all time. She's brought women's tennis to a whole new level. I think all the girls in the draw now, you know, have looked back at Serena and taken inspiration from her, really, over the last years. And, you know, she deserves it. And as does her sister Serena, by the way, who's still playing at a year older. She's nearly 42, and she's playing as well. So amazing, the two of them, and have just been, you know, transformative, really, in the women's game of tennis.
Venus plays her opening match tonight, doesn't she?
Yeah, she plays tonight. You know, I don't expect her to go too far with that. She is playing against Alison van Oostrom, who's a Belgian girl, who's not in great form either. But Venus hasn't won a match in a main event for a long time, so I don't really expect her to go much further with that. You know, just go back to Serena, I guess. I thought she played better last night than she has done recently. She doesn't have many matches under her belt. She's only played 4 matches since Wimbledon. You might remember she went out there to kind of an unknown French girl called Harmony Tan, and she's only won 1 match since then, so hasn't really got any form. But I thought last night there were signs that maybe the training she's been doing over the last couple of months is coming to some fruition. She's playing better, doing better, better. So let's just see how she gets out of Kontaveit, but that's not an easy matchup for her number 2 seed.
You mentioned the word transformative there, Gina, and I suppose as a whole, like, what has she done for the game? Not only for the game of tennis, but in terms of female representation in sport and the wider public as well, because she's so well known off the court as well, and she's been such an icon and a genuine leader.
Yeah, and she's just been so transformative in that way. She's an absolute superstar of women's sport, and put women's sport kind of front and centre, you know, and we're talking a lot about, you know, women in sport and trying to promote that, and she's never been shy about putting herself forward and demanding that she get the attention she deserves and get the prime time slots and that kind of thing. So, yeah, no, completely transformative. And even in the way that she plays, the aggressive style that she has, the power that she has, she's not afraid to have that power and to show that. And you can see that now with the current crop of girls. They're out there, you know, whacking the ball and killing it and being physical out there.
She has brought women's tennis so far, but I did find it interesting reading one article this afternoon. Ignis Swiatek was given out about the fact that women and men use different balls at the US Open. Why is that still the case? I mean, a lot of the top pros aren't happy about it. Have they not got enough say over the US Open to use the balls they'd like to use?
No, I mean, it seems extraordinary, doesn't it, in this day and age that would be the case, but I'm trying to change the way that the flight of the ball, that the way the men hit the ball is slightly different to the women, so that's why they use a different ball. But you would think, yeah, I mean, the two tours, WTA Tour and ATP Tour, there's been a lot of talk for a long time about those tours amalgamating, and I think that will happen in the future, and then probably be a bit more cohesion between the two tours. I think that's the way they want it to go.
Will be interesting to see how it pans out indeed. I know we were chatting so much about Serena, and rightly so, but Gina, the wider draw on the women's side of the US Open, because I know we'll be focusing, Marie will be back tomorrow and focusing on the men's side of the US Open draw tomorrow, but we are chatting the women's singles side of the draw this evening. So as Ruby mentioned there, Iga Swiatek very much the world number one, but however, her form has been somewhat underwhelming of late, so by no means a certainty to win in New York. It could be almost anyone, you know, and I suppose we saw that last year with Emma Raducanu, who kind of came from nowhere really, but perhaps given her form as well, it would be a brave punter that backs her to repeat. So it's a very wide open competition.
Yeah, it's really wide open, and you saw another qualifier doing well last night, so Simona Halep, who has had a bit of form recently, and in fact won the warm-up event in Toronto. She lost last night to a qualifier, Daria Snigur from Ukraine, and, you know, very unexpected loss there. Snigur was a qualifier, ranked 124, does have a little bit of junior form. She won Junior Wimbledon in 2019, but that was her first ever, not only her first ever Grand Slam, but her first ever WTA event. So an extraordinary performance from her last night against somebody who had shown some form recently. Swiatek, as you say, hasn't been in the greatest form recently, but she went on that amazing run earlier on in the year where she had 37 wins unbeaten up until third round Wimbledon. You couldn't rule her out. She's definitely the best player in the world this year. Otherwise, I think the Americans in general are there to be looked out for. So Coco Gauff is in good form at the moment. Jessie Pegula has had a good run at the warm-up events. Daughter of the Buffalo Bills owner. And in general, American women's tennis seems to be on the up. 7 of the 32 seeds are American. So a couple of names there to look out for.
On Swiatek though, Gina, because I was reading a couple of quotes before the tournament started, and you know, it was kind of evocative language. She described herself as nervous in Toronto and Cincinnati, but feels that she can lower her expectations and just focus on improving and on tennis. I mean, is this just a minor dip in form, or perhaps something more?
Yeah, I think it's a minor dip. I think she's a very deep thinker, assesses and analyzes everything. And maybe that run of form that she had winning all the matches and then getting a loss, it's knocked her back a little bit. But I don't think it's going to take very much for her to turn back on. And she gets a couple of rounds under her belt here. I think she could be a good bet for the win.
You're fancying the world number one, but for all tennis fans looking in, 128 has become 64. If Serena can win tomorrow night, that becomes 32. Is it a fairy tale, or how far can she go? Where do you expect her to go?
Gina, still there?
Sorry, I couldn't hear you there for 1 second. I just lost you there for a second.
No, at all.
Serena, you were saying how far can Serena go?
Yeah, I mean, it's down to 128 became 64, it'll come 32 on Wednesday night.
If she did manage to get past Kontaveit, you'd be looking at, she'd play Tom Lanovich next, the Australian. It's certainly a winnable match for her. She could then potentially play Leila Fernandez, who was, remember, the finalist last year, so another strong player. And then you're looking at Ons Jabeur possibly in the quarterfinals. But I'd be surprised if she gets past Kontaveit. But let's see. It could be the fairy tale. She'd love it.
And certainly many fans would love it too. Gina Nyland, thank you very much for previewing, as I say, the women's side of the draw. Marie will be chatting the men's side of the draw tomorrow as our coverage of the US Open continues. However, Ruby, we're going out the same way we came in, because Alan Keane and Mark Rossiter will be back in studio. Mark Langdon will be joining us, and we'll be crossing to a couple of Premier League rounds with a few reporters as well, because we're going to chat association football, Premier League action, transfers, the whole lot. So stay with us here in 2FM. Football.
Well, welcome back to Game On, where we are indeed going to talk football and transfer news as deadline day approaches. And joining us on the line, as usual on a Tuesday night, is Mark Langdon of the Racing Post. Mark, Anthony has confirmed his move to Manchester United from Ajax. $81.3 million for the Brazilian. Eric Ten Hag wanted him, and now he has him. Mark, there now.
Is Mark with us?
Hello, Ruby.
Yeah,
you okay?
We're there. Yeah, we're good. Mark,
how's things? You may have missed Ruby's very elegant and long-winded question there, Ruby. So
some cheeks in my questions are long-winded.
I heard the last bit about Anthony had signed for Manchester United. Would he be worth it?
Don't only worth it. Ten Hag got him and wanted him. Is he?
Right? Yeah, I mean that's the main thing. I think that, you know, United have backed Ten Hag, they've got one of his main targets. I mean, there's no doubt that they've overpaid for Anthony. He's somebody that has got an absolute bag of tricks. He's got a lot of pace. Will play on the right wing. People got upset with Richarlison's showboating on Sunday. They've seen nothing yet because Anthony's a very fun player. Ten Hag obviously knows him really well. He's somebody that I think will adapt to the Premier League. But it's a big step up, and you know, we've seen Eredivisie players before not always sort of take to it straight away, and that's why I think it's really expensive. But there's no doubt that United needed to do something in that final third. Recent results have improved, but it doesn't take much, I don't think, to work out that it's not exactly the football that Ten Hag wants to play. He's just doing it out of necessity. So Anthony on one wing, probably Sancho on another. You know, gives that option maybe to put Rashford through the middle, and a really pacey front three for United, I think.
Yeah, a bit of pace there. But City, you obviously have Erling Haaland for a song. When you look at what other players are costing, have invested in a centre half in Manuel Akanji coming from Borussia Dortmund.
First of all, just on Haaland, I mean, it's a funny deal because there's a lot of fees that have gone out to agents, and I think it's probably more expensive than it just looks like on paper. So maybe a little bit unfair to sort of, you know, compare Haaland to other deals just because of the way that one was structured. In terms of Akanji, I mean, this is a great move for him. He's a year left on his contract at Borussia Dortmund. He's good on the ball, which is probably why Pep Guardiola has identified him as somebody that can come in and play for Manchester City, and it'll allow Nathan Ake maybe to go and move out into that sort of left-back spot if Cancelo's not available. But hasn't really impressed defensively, I think it's fair to say, for Borussia Dortmund, and it's really hard defending for Man City because when you play centre-back for them, you know, you are 2v2 a lot of the time. They are exposed, those centre-backs. So be interesting to see how he deals with that. But I think what has caught the eye really with Akanji is the fact that he can really play out from the back. And, you know, Pep Guardiola rates that, I think, as much as anything else in his defenders. Can you give the ball to the midfielders really quickly? And that is something that he can do. I don't expect him to play in the biggest games, though, when everybody's fit. I think he's very much a backup.
Ruby, Mark, you were mentioning there some very valid points, but you mentioned, I think, what caught Alan Keane and Mark Rossiter's ears and had a wry smile on their faces was Richarlison's showboating. Gentlemen, I have to ask the question, what did you make of it all? Alan, I'll start with you first. I feel Mark might be a bit more, he should have been 2 foot, never mind 1 foot.
Yeah, definitely. He should have been done waist high, definitely. It's frustrating. Just being, I suppose, popped off the way it is, but showboating like that, no, sorry, I'm not having it. I'd gladly take a red card for that.
Oh, okay. Wasn't expecting that. Mark?
I don't think there's anything wrong with what Richarlison did, but I don't think that there's anything wrong with the tackle that went in on him either. Genuinely, you know, he left himself for it, but Richarlison's a big boy. He just gets up and gets on with it. So I think he left himself open to the tackle. He took the tackle and that was it. But I don't think there's anything wrong with it because obviously you're playing for the public, but at the same time, I don't think there was anything wrong with the tackle, and I think 99% of people would be delighted that he got buried with the tackle, to be honest.
the art form of tackling is gone. That's what. Well, you know, I agree with you, and I know we're having a bit of a tongue in cheek conversation, but it is serious as well. And Didi Haman's comments in terms of it's unsportsmanlike behaviour and so on. Mark, I don't know how well that was received both in England and across Europe in terms of Didi's point of view with showboating and sportsmanlike. Mark Langdon, that is. Sorry.
Yeah, I know Diddy reasonably well. I was a bit surprised. I mean, I'm not sure that Richarlison should have been yellow carded for the action. I suppose it was a slightly unsportsmanlike, but I think Diddy went a little bit too far, and again, Richarlison fired back, didn't he, on Twitter, telling Diddy to cry a little bit more. I tend to agree that there wasn't that much wrong with what he did, but you're not going to get away with that, I don't think, away from home. You are going to get clattered for doing it, and Richarlison took that and got back up again. I don't think it will stop him. I think he'll carry on doing the flicks and the tricks. That is something that's in his makeup, and I don't think necessarily should be taken away from his game. I suppose that the one thing that, I mean, I don't see it as a bigger crime than sort of, you know, hacking the player. I mean, that was suggested that, you know, that it's one of the biggest sins in kind of British football is for somebody to do that. I mean, you know, we maybe have a different conversation if Richarlison would have snapped his leg in that moment. So, I mean, I think it was it was taken the right way by Richarlison. He didn't, I think he expected the kick, and he took the kick, and it kind of just ran down the clock for another 30 seconds. And it's maybe a little bit of a shame because it took away, you know, what was a really big impact from him when he came on. And putting that superb cross for the second goal, and since he's arrived at Tottenham, he hasn't been given that many minutes. But when he has been on the pitch, he looked very lively. I think he is pushing Son, now for a starting spot. Maybe not against West Ham, but potentially for that game against Fulham at the weekend. I'd be surprised if he doesn't start one of the next two. That's for sure.
Mark, in La Liga, Valencia have taken Edison Cavani onto their books. Was with PSG, then Manchester United, 35 years of age. Looked like he'd run a brilliant player. Was running out of a bit of speed at Old Trafford, though.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that he's kind of best days are behind him. He's somebody that still gives a lot of effort, and I'm pleased that he's got his move to Spain, because that's where he said he wanted to go. Valencia got beat 1-0 at the weekend by Atletico Madrid. Shows that they've got problems up front. They haven't got that much money either, so it was probably a good deal for them, really, and they were able to bring in somebody relatively cheap with a lot of experience. I think Gattuso, the Valencia manager, will be expecting Cavani to show up and to kind of work and run around like he does. You know, he can't do it quite as well as what he did a few years ago, but I don't see it. He's not the kind of veteran that will just kind of stand up front and not try and just expect sort of the ball to be sort of put on his head every time. You know, he will give it his best, and he probably shows where he and Valencia are, that they've ended up together. But at least he's got his move to Spain, and like I say, he will still be committed. And as he showed for Manchester United, if the ball is around the penalty area, you know, his one touch finish, he's still as good as most strikers out there. You know, he's got unbelievable movement, and I don't think he'll lose that. You know, even at his age, he's still got that brain there. So probably for Valencia, it's not a bad deal, and it's a good one for Cavani, because, like I say, he was desperate to go to Spanish football, and he's got his move. He was never going to play for one of the top teams in Spain, so he's probably found his level, I think, at Valencia.
Gennaro Gattuso. Now, there's a man that wouldn't like a bit of showboating, I'd imagine, as well. That imagery of him and Joe Jordan, I think it was, a few years ago in the Champions League, is still fresh in mind. But let's come full circle and chat English Premier League fixtures that are on this evening, because Russell Hargreaves is at Craven Cottage, and there could be some showboating there, because Brighton had the opportunity, Russell, albeit early days, to go top of the English Premier League.
Yes, a very, very good evening to the banks of the Thames, and you are absolutely right. They were briefly top in-game earlier in the season, but were they to make it 4 wins and a draw from 5 Graham Potter's men, they would be top tonight, and as you rightly say, first ever time, top tier, not just Premier League, but indeed the old Division 1 as well. It would be one almighty achievement, wouldn't it? Sitting fourth, heading in, and as for Fulham, largely a case of so far so good for the Cottagers as well. Not quite as impressive, but 5 points so far, 4 of them at home. They are just settling back in nicely to the top tier, and probably more effectively than the last two times they yo-yoed up, having gone straight back down again. They were agonisingly pipped late on 2-1 against leaders Arsenal away last time out, played well, mightily unlucky in many regards. And as for Brighton, their latest win, of course, was a hard-fought 1-0 against Leeds United, who'd just beaten Chelsea in their game prior. So a couple of informed teams. In terms of the lineups, quickly, Fulham, first of all, unchanged to the side that lost out against Arsenal late on, still no Man or Solomon or Harry Wilson, and Shane Duffy is ineligible against his parent club, but plenty of focus as ever on Aleksandar Mitrovic. 4 goals already this Premier League season, looking like a proper handful up top, the Serb. And as for Brighton, one change to the team that beat Leeds, that's the Zambian international Enoch Mwepu. He replaces Danny Welbeck up front. Defender Joel Veltman has passed a late fitness test, but Adam Lallana, the veteran midfielder, out until at least next month with a calf injury. Those are the teams, that's the backdrop, and we kick off in just over 35 minutes time for Fulham Brighton here at the Cottage.
Russell Hargreaves, thank you very much. I did say we're going to chat Premier League fixtures, but you know what? Fulham are playing. Scott Parker used to manage Fulham. He also used to manage Bournemouth as well. And that brings us on to our topic of conversation with managerial departures, because I know we covered Keith Long at the top of the show. Alan Keane, I want to go to you because your beloved Sligo Rovers obviously had a managerial change during the year that we mentioned earlier, with John Russell coming in to take over from Liam Buckley as well. On the Scott Parker situation, I mean, 4 games in, 3 losses, albeit Liverpool, City and Arsenal. I know the wording of the Bournemouth statement talked about sustainability and alignment and so on. It seemed like the writing was on the wall here regardless of results.
Yeah, I think so. And I suppose the 9-0 drubbing by Liverpool over the weekend didn't help. But I think from the start of the season, when you look back on Scott's interviews, he was always kind of giving out about not getting these sign-ins and not being backed or in a different way. So as you said, the statement kind of says it as it is, that it didn't meet the alignments and what they wanted, and the 9-0 probably made it easier for them to sack him. You know, if he'd gone and beaten Liverpool, it was just delaying the inevitable, really. And look, it's always disappointing to see a manager lose his job, but as I said, football's so unforgiving these days, you don't get much time.
You do not, and that was evident than at Elland Road, where Jesse March has taken over now. They're playing Everton this evening, and Adam Duru is there for us.
Yes, absolutely. Well, until their defeats at Brighton, their last league match, Leeds were unbeaten at the start of the season, but despite that setback, 7 points out of a possible 12 remains a solid start for Jesse Marsh's side, who were widely expected to be scrapping to avoid relegation at the start of the season. In contrast, Frank Lampard's Everton side have made heavy weather of their opening set of fixtures. Indeed, they were perhaps a bit fortunate to come away with a draw against an informed Brentford side. And yet, to pick up a league win, and with a series of challenging fixtures on the horizon, the pressure is on the Toffees to end that drought. They'll be hoping that new signing Neil Malpay will be the man to provide the firepower, although it's still yet to be seen if he's going to feature tonight. Kickoff is at 8 o'clock. It's Leeds versus Everton at Elland Road.
Thank you very much, Adam. Mark Langdon, Chelsea are away to Southampton. Southampton, of course, tried their best against Man United on Saturday, but Chelsea, they've won 6 of their last 7 trips to St Mary's.
Yeah, I was at Whitehall Lane to see Tottenham against Southampton on the opening day. They were quite lightweight in many areas of the pitch, but one player that really impressed me, Lavia, the young teenager in central midfield. I mean, they picked him up from Manchester City. He looks extraordinary talent for somebody so young to be so composed in midfield. So excited to see him again. But you just look at kind of that Chelsea team, and there is a lot of quality in there with Havertz, Sterling and Ziyech up front. I still think they need a forward if they want to sort of, you know, cement that top four positions. It looks very competitive this year, but I would expect that front three, a lot of fluidity in it, to be able to get the job done at St Mary's. But Southampton in midfield with Ward-Prowse and Lavia looks probably a team that's improved as the season went on. When I saw them on the opening day, it felt to me like they would definitely get relegated. They were awful, but they've definitely improved since then. So I expect them to put up a decent fight, but probably lose the game.
And Mark Rossiter, that is. Speaking of Chelsea, I know Hudson-Odoi looks like he's off to Leverkusen on loan with an option to recall. Fofana could be on the way to Stamford Bridge. Is Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang the answer to Chelsea's forward issues?
Yeah, he's an unbelievable player if his head is right. He was, you know, when Thierry Henry left Arsenal, he stepped into his shoes and he done really well for them, until he decided that he wanted to leave to go to Barcelona. So seemed like he downed tools, or for whatever reason he was captain and he was stripped of it and stuff like that. So look, he's a fabulous player if he just does his thing on the pitch. So he'd be a huge signing for Chelsea.
He most certainly would, after being involved in a aggravated burglary at the weekend in his own home, so I hope he's okay after that. But the final match in the Premier League tonight does see Tent play 12th. Mark Langdon, Crystal Palace, Bree, Brentford. They played out 2-0, dull nil-all draws last year, but the way they're going this year suggests there could be goals in this game.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the Palace really have improved over the last sort of 12 months under Patrick Vieira, a much more expressive team than what they were under Roy Hodgson. And you look at Eze and Elise and Zaha, you know, players that can really, you know, good technical ability that can hurt opponents. And Brentford always play on the front foot. King Lewis Potter starting for them tonight in what looks like a front three with Mbeumo and Tony. So a lot of quality really in both teams. That's made the big question for Palace fans: is this going to be the last time that Will Zaha is at Selhurst Park in a Palace shirt? There's sort of been strong rumours linking him with Chelsea and Arsenal, of course, in the last year of his contract. Transfer window closes on Thursday. Those Palace fans will be absolutely desperate to see Zaha remain, obviously, an absolute cult hero at Selhurst.
Absolutely. Mark Langdon, gentlemen, as always, thank you very much. Mark Rossiter, Alan Keane, still with us. And Ruby, because you threw some shade at me earlier, I'm going to try and catch you off guard now. I'm going to go round the houses here for predictions in the FAI Cup quarterfinals. And I'm going to start with yourself, Ruby. So, Shelburne or Bohemians?
Bo's new manager on the bounce. Be unlucky for Shells.
Okay, wrong answer, but okay. Treaty United, UCD, Ruby?
In Limerick, Treaty United.
Okay, Waterford, Dundalk?
I think then Waterford beat St. Pat's as well. They could get a result there.
Oh, okay. And Derry Rovers?
Derry Rovers, a lot of pressure on Derry at home. Rovers will beat them.
Okay, there you go. Okay. Gents, we are stuck for time, so I'm going to have to split the
prediction. You're better off asking the lads what they think.
Well, that's I'm going to split the predictions here. I'm going to split the predictions. Mark, I'm going to start with yourself. Shells, Bows, impartial answer, please.
Bows,
okay. Treaty, UCD?
UCD.
Alan, Waterford, Dundalk?
Dundalk.
And I'll rephrase my question. Derry or Shams?
I think Derry will do them in the Brandywell, yeah.
Okay, there you go. Ruby Walsh, thank you very much. Mark Rossiter, thank you very much. Alan Keane, thank you very much. Tara Kumar is up next, so do stay tuned to 2FM. Marie Crowe is back at the same time tomorrow. But from all of the Game On team, well, it's bye for now.